Thanks for tuning in to Does Not Compute, and thanks to Linode for sponsoring today's episode. Linode provides SSD-backed virtual servers at an incredible price. In fact, their RAM offerings across all plans are double what most competitors offer at the same price points. You can get a 1GB server for only $5 a month, or a high-memory server starting at only $60 a month for 16GB. Linode has 8 data centers around the world, which makes it incredibly simple to get your servers as close as possible to your users. As I mentioned before, all Linode boxes run on native SSD storage, but they also use Intel E5 processors and run across a 40GB network. Linode also provides some great add-on services to make managing your servers as simple as possible. You can enable automated backups and use Longview and node balancers to help you keep track of system metrics and scale out your infrastructure. Since you get full control over your virtual machines, you can encrypt the disks, run Docker containers, VPN servers, Git servers, and more. Linode has a special offer for Does Not Compute listeners. If you check out linode.com/doesnotcompute and sign up using the promo code DoesNotCompute2017, they'll give you a $20 account credit. Make sure to check out Linode today by visiting linode.com/doesnotcompute. Okay, so just before we started recording, you told me that you bought a new computer.
I did. I did do that. It was a moment of weakness, but I did it.
We all have our vices.
Yeah, what was funny was I was trying to explain to you my reasoning. And you shot it. You shot a hole in it right away. And I was like, let me do it. Let me explain this.
Sometimes you just need a new computer.
Well, yeah. And there's a few specific reasons why. So my previous setup was a 12-inch MacBook, which I still really like that computer, and a 27-inch iMac. And so what I'm doing is Jamie has an iMac, but it's like pre-SSD day. It doesn't even have a Fusion Drive in it. Nor does it have a Retina screen. And so she does a lot of photography stuff. She's kind of like makes a little bit of money on the side doing it too. So I was like, here, you can have this iMac. It's Retina, has an SSD, 2 TB of hard drive. You can fit all your stuff on it. It'd be great. And then I'll just go ahead and buy something new. And then she was like, that sounds good, you know? Because if I would have been like, let me just buy this, she'd be like, do you really need that? But, you know. So I'm going to be traveling a little bit more this summer, headed to California for a bit, maybe a couple other places. And while the 12-inch MacBook has been great, for the most part, it kind of bogs down a little bit now when I'm running some Elixir apps and some Rails apps at the same time, along with some Docker services. I've moved all of my like homebrew stuff to Docker, basically. And you know, then I'm running too many Slacks and all the other reasons, I guess, why 8 gigs isn't just enough. It's just not enough RAM, especially if you have some of the DevOps stuff and the Docker stuff going. So I ended up picking up a 13-inch MacBook Pro, the 2016 model, but I got the one without a touch bar.
So you got the 12-inch, the 13-inch. You got to get a 14-inch, a 15-inch, a 16-inch, 17-inch. And then eventually you transition to a desktop. You get the 21-inch, the 22-inch.
Right. Well, I have an iPad Pro, which is just
gotta catch them all.
I have the small iPad Pro. So it's like iPad Pro, MacBook, MacBook Pro. And then
a screen for every occasion.
Yeah. So I haven't I can still return this if I want to. I haven't formatted any of my other computers and such, but I'm really liking it so far. It's kind of stupid, but maybe my favorite thing about it is actually the keyboard. I've been feuding with my MacBook for months now. I just hating how the keyboard feels. I don't know where it just happened out of nowhere one day. I was just like, I don't like this.
That's pretty interesting. I still really enjoy I've always really liked the MacBook keyboard. It's definitely not as solid as the Magic Keyboard, but I find it quite pleasant to type on personally.
Yeah, the MacBook Pro, the 2016 MacBook Pro keyboard feels much more like the Magic Keyboard to me. It feels clicky, which I like a lot. And my MacBook didn't. It just felt like I was tapping on metal almost. Which I don't know what the deal is. You know, I've cleaned it. I showed you my canless air system thing that blows air 200 miles an hour, Paul. And I'll shoot that into the keyboard. Nothing comes out. So I don't know what the deal is, but it just drives me crazy. And it's one of those stupid things that once you notice it, you can't unnotice it. And so I'll try to work and I'll try to concentrate. And then that thought will creep. Like, I just hate this keyboard. And then there goes all of my productivity because I'm hating I don't like typing on it. So I really enjoy the keyboard on the new MacBook Pro.
So actually a little bit of a show level announcement thing, I guess. But we are actually going to be trying out doing a does not compute as live stream sort of thing over the next couple of weeks here. This is something we've been discussing for a little bit. And it's probably going to be something that we put up on Twitch, and we're both going to be kind of hosting it, just like how we do with the podcast. But we're going to be doing a lot more stuff with obviously screen sharing and showing actual code and examples of things that we're working on and what we're talking about as we talk about it. So hopefully that'll be kind of a cool thing. I mean, I'm pretty excited at least.
I'm looking forward to it. It means that I have to get my typing game together, because you know as well as I do that I can't type when people are looking at me. Just falls apart. But I'm really, I don't know, I'm just excited to get more points of view on the code that I write, especially because I work alone. You know, I post snippets in different Slack channels and say, hey, what do you think about this? But it's a little bit different because they don't have as much context, you know? Yep. And at that point, I've already kind of thought through things. And so I've written it down and then showed it to them. Whereas I think with the live stream, especially if we're doing some pair programming stuff or some feature development stuff, I think that having direct input from someone watching is going to be pretty interesting for me anyway. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think what's really nice about this for both of us in particular is that we both happen to be in a situation that is pretty rare, which is that we can actually share a lot of the stuff that we're working on. We aren't under a lot of the restrictions that many people are when they work at companies, or even when they're doing contract work, because you can't really show off your contract work either. But we're both kind of in charge of our dev teams, as it were,
right?
Our singular dev teams of one.
I'm the master
and
of my own domain.
And so we can kind of make these decisions around like, oh, this part of the code I'm okay with sharing and explaining and walking people through, versus, you know, maybe some stuff you'll still want to keep private. But I think it's a shame to not take advantage of that. So I'm really, really excited that we're going to be able to do that a little bit more.
Yeah, it's kind of cool because it kind of gives us a... So I was talking with my boss, and we're eventually wanting to do kind of what Cushion has been doing, is kind of just like a dev blog, or like a more of a journal, I guess, on development and feature development and how things, you know, how... like the process of how things are being made. You know, I think that could be really interesting for the people that are using our platform, you know, such as the store owners, because it gives them a peek behind the curtain, I think. And so I think this could, you know, help with that as well, because it just, I don't know, I'm not really used to, like, I don't do a lot of open source work, right? So I don't do a lot of development in the open. The code that I write is tucked away behind private, you know, a private gate, and no one can see it but me. So for me, it's going to be really stretching because it's kind of removing that gate, like the cover from stuff. So I think it's going to, you know, it could benefit Design Collective because, hey, we're kind of putting ourselves out there. You know, eventually the dev team is going to want to grow, and maybe this could be a good option for, you know, finding people that could be eligible for that. I don't know. But then, you know, the other bird is that it's going to stretch me and force me to become more comfortable with sharing that type of thing. And I mean, I think any time that you feel uncomfortable like that, it's a good thing. You know, it's a good thing to be stretched like that.
Oh yeah, every single time I've had a career thing where I'm like, oh, this feels like I'm really being pushed a lot here, I've come out the other side of it and been like, that was probably the best possible thing that I could have chosen to do at that point.
Yeah, yeah. So I am really looking forward to it. I just have to, like I said, get my fingers unconfused. Because when I know, it's kind of like when you're playing an instrument sometimes, you know someone's watching you. You can just shred in your room and you go into public and you sound like you've been playing guitar for a week maybe. It's kind of similar feeling. I've been typing for years, I promise. But
and we got to get all the technical issues sorted out. We've been demoing video chat service after video chat service and having some sort of issue with just about every single one. So there's lots of technical stuff to work out and all that. But hopefully, I mean, we'll probably be doing maybe some test streams over the next couple of weeks here. And we will maybe announce those on Twitter. We're planning it live.
Yeah, Twitter sounds good. I like Twitter.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll probably do some announcements about upcoming test streams and all that sort of stuff for anybody interested on Twitter. And then we're planning for the first official stream to go out on Monday, May 5th at noon Pacific. So 3 p.m. Eastern.
Yep.
And that's like what, 7 p.m. GMT? Something like that?
I'd have to look at my...
There will be announcements. But that's what we're shooting for right now. Monday the 5th at noonish Pacific.
That's one of my favorite things about iStat menus, I think it's called. Paul, if you've never check that out, is that when I click on my time, I see all the different time zones underneath. So I have one for UTC and I have one for East Coast and West Coast, so that I don't have to try and do the math in my head anymore.
That is super cool. I have used iStat menus before, but I did not know about that feature, and I will check that out.
Yeah, I use it. I use it a lot.
Because I am constantly translating between time zones right now.
Yeah, yeah. So speaking of figuring out some of these technical issues, I have inner turmoil happening, and I need some help figuring out what to do about an external monitor.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so you won't have that iMac anymore, so I guess you're looking for something new.
Yeah, so I looked at the LGs that Apple just released, and they're so expensive. Like a 27-inch 5K, I think the 5K one is like $1,300.
Not only are they really expensive, I've heard there's actually some pretty significant issues with them as well. The big one that I've heard about is if they're near a Wi-Fi router, they receive interference, like visible interference from them.
Yeah, so I looked at
the... So there's some pretty big issues with those for sure.
I looked at the reviews and they were a ton. Like, I mean, normally you're going to see several or a few bad reviews, but they were just mostly negative about having problems, about the computer locking up with a specific version of Mac OS. The volume controls don't even work, apparently.
Oh,
so that was my big reservation was, you know, so the computer doesn't have any buttons on it. You plug it in, it turns on. You unplug it, it turns off. USB-C, that is. You unplug it from your computer, it turns off.
Right.
So all of that depends on the software, and I don't know that I trust the software enough, or I trust software enough to control all of that stuff about an external monitor, especially not when that's $1,300.
Yeah, exactly. Like a $1,300 monitor, I want it to have more connections. I want it to be for sure reliable and not get messed up by things like Wi-Fi routers. I mean, who's right. ever going to use a Wi-Fi router around a computer monitor, right? That's crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy. So I've done some research, and I do know that I want a USB-C monitor. I'm actually coming around to USB-C. I like the idea of it a lot. And I think it really kind of comes to fruition when you look at a USB-C monitor, where you have your external monitor and you plug one cable into your computer, and every port on the back of the computer, like basically your monitor turns into a dongle. And also it charges your computer at the same time, which I think is pretty nice. So I've worked with like laptops and external display setups before, and it's always kind of a hassle, like leaving and coming back, because you have to move all your cables around. You have to plug them all in. You have to put your computer into clamshell mode, and you know, oh crap, I forgot to plug it in. So it just put itself to sleep, and just kind of like these annoying things. And it seems like the newer USB-C monitors, you can just walk up, plug one cord in, and you're good to go.
I actually had the Acer H277 something. 277HU monitor for a while, and that's a USB-C monitor. I was using it with my MacBook when I was using that as my primary computer for a while, and that monitor was actually not that great in my experience. I had a lot of issues with it would like turn off and on repeatedly, kind of screen flickering stuff, or just things wouldn't, like the pass-through USB wouldn't work sometimes, and I would have to reboot. And so right now, at least, I feel like you're definitely on the right track with saying, I'm not sure that I trust the software.
Right. Yeah.
Because right now it still seems pretty bad in a lot of cases.
And I'm
hoping that next generation is really going to change a lot of this.
Yeah, me too. And I'm okay waiting for a while. I don't need a 27-inch screen. I mean, I'm only flipping between a code editor and VS Code. I use the VS Code terminal. So I'm not even flipping through iTerm. I'm not even flipping through three windows. I'm just flipping through two, unless I have to run over to Slack. So I'm pretty okay waiting. Like the resolution I have it scaled out, and it's large enough, and it's good for testing anyway, with the 13-inch screen, because the vast majority of users of Design Collective
more realistic.
Don't have, yeah, they yeah. aren't using IMAX, you know?
Yep.
So I'm okay with it. It, you know, it makes my desk look cleaner, and I like a clean desk. I just wiped my entire desk down with Old English. It's nice. Shiny now.
Nice.
Yeah, so I'm pretty okay with waiting. I mean, I was looking at a couple of LG models that weren't the Apple ones, and they look okay, but I used to just spend, like, I would see something, and if I wasn't completely happy with it, I would buy it anyway. Just I would find some way to justify it, and I don't want to do that with this monitor, so I'm just not going
to. I would probably hold off for the new Dell that's coming out. They announced it a couple months ago, and I've always had absolutely fantastic luck with Dell monitors.
Yeah, I have too. I've only ever owned external Dell monitors. I've never had an LG before or anything.
Their
like that.
Computers are garbage, but their monitors top notch.
Yeah. The other thing that interests me about a Dell monitor is the VESA arm. I think that that could be something that's really cool to use. And so I might, you know, if there's a new Dell coming out, is it a 4K?
Dude, you're getting a Dell.
I would probably be getting a Dell, yeah. And that's the other thing. I'm deciding, I was looking at some widescreen ones too, because I've seen some people that are using like 34-inch curved monitors, and they're like, I love it. But none of those are 4K either. I don't know if that's a deal breaker for me. Like, I just don't know. Because I'm not...
It looks like the Dell one is a 1440p. So 2560, 1440.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a deal breaker for me or not. Like, I don't do anything that depends on having a Retina monitor.
Yeah, I'm still on a 1440p, like an old school non-Retina 27-inch iMac, and I love it. I mean, it's a great resolution, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I was thinking about it earlier, and it made me feel really... just happy with how far we've come in terms of like the web development and support and stuff. Like when we were working back together, like when we first started working together, we're doing like all these sprites, CSS sprites. You made that tool that I used.
Man.
I used that tool for like 2 years that'll calculate the sprite for you, or the dimensions or position rather. But I mean, the only raster stuff that I work with now is photos that people upload as content. And that's, that's not like, you don't need a Retina monitor to deal with that anymore. So I don't think that a 14K is a deal breaker. And to me, like when I look at the USB-C 14K monitors, again, I don't know if I trust the software enough. And it's so much more expensive for just a 14K to have a 14K monitor. So again, I don't know. 4K.
1440p versus I gotcha. I just wanted to make sure I was understanding. Yeah, man, it's amazing how quickly that changed, right? With the sprites to everything being SVG and only user-generated content being raster.
Yeah.
It was just, it felt like almost overnight. It felt like it was never, ever going to happen. And then it felt like, oh, wow, when did that happen?
I think there was a point in time where we were all just kind of like, screw it, we're going to do it anyway. And we, for me, that's kind of what it was.
That's what it was.
You know? I was like, hey, James, what's the contract for browser support? And I was like, let's bump it up a version. And then I was like, screw it. We're using SVG. You know, obviously, if a client specifically requested IE9 or something like that, then we would do it. But that was kind of the moment where I was like, we're doing it.
I think in a lot of ways, kind of what made that transition and that, whatever, I'm just going to do it attitude possible was Grunticon.
Yeah.
Grunticon was huge during that transitional period where you still did have to support some of the older browsers and you needed to generate fallbacks, but who's going to do that by hand?
Right.
But now, like these days, I just use SVGs.
Yeah.
Unless there's a very specific reason that I need to not use an SVG.
And even now, Webpack will just inline it for you if it's small enough.
Yep.
It's a thing of the past. It was funny because I was looking at the monitors and was like, do I really need a 4K? And it dawned on me that I don't really need one. I don't think anyway.
I mean, even when you're doing dev for Retina displays on a non-Retina display, it's so much easier now. Like with the tools that you have available in Chrome for testing responsive and various DPIs, it's trivial to get that testing in, or at least like good enough for a quick check, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's not an issue. So, and even if it were, I have the MacBook has a screen still, so I could just drag a window over to that and check it. You know, it's not a huge deal. So I don't know, maybe for the time being, I might check out, it's like a widescreen monitor is really not that expensive. They're a lot cheaper than a 4K monitor for sure. So I might check that out. That's piquing my interest.
It's a lot less pixels to push too.
Yeah. That's true.
Just in terms of overall day-to-day performance.
So the only time my fans have turned on this thing is when I restart the computer and all of my Dockers are starting, my Docker machines. Well, really just one machine. All of my containers are starting with everything else. And then other than that, it's been phenomenal. It's super fast, plenty of RAM. I haven't had any problems with it. Snappy. The battery lasts a long time. So I really like this computer. I think the second thing that I like about it after the keyboard is that it feels like a solid chunk of aluminum. I could throw it out my window and it would be fine.
Did Apple pay you to say that?
They didn't.
They would probably pay you to not say that.
Please do not
throw your MacBook out the window.
I mean, that's not like my Mac. I dropped my MacBook 12-inch once and it was totally fine and it barely had a ding on it. I was getting out of a car and my backpack was open for some reason and just straight onto the concrete. And it's just totally fine. So I don't know. The last couple of generations, I think, have been awesome. Because I'm remembering the last time I had a MacBook Pro, I think you could push on the lid and it kind of like sank in a little bit.
Yeah, their build quality has definitely gotten extremely good.
Yeah. So, you know, I have my justifications, and so far they're paying off. So I'm pretty sure I'll be keeping this one, and you know, I'll probably be selling my 12 inch and selling the other MacBook or the other iMac that we have. So, but we'll see what happens down the road.
So are you still continuing on with the great Elixir migration for Design Collective?
Yep. I am.
Going well?
It's going well. Yeah. It's going real well. So I think the big thing is, and it's kind of validating still, is that we've had another crop of stores come onto the store. And so we're getting more like front facing traffic, but we're also having way more, admin side traffic, and the RAM is just slowly increasing up again. So it's way more stable than it was before, but now instead of idling at like 40%, it's idling at 50%, or just like kind of hovering at 50%. So while I put the fire out, there's obviously going to be some more fires for scaling. So that kind of validates my decision even further, because I honestly would probably spend as much time profiling and rewriting stuff in Ruby in the Rails side as I would just be writing it in Elixir. Because I think I remember we mentioned last time how I'm feeling. I feel pretty productive. I'm not having to look stuff up all the time. I'm able to just create. So I honestly think that I could probably finish writing the Elixir port before I could actually restructure the foundation on the other side of the Rails app.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you're sending me snippets all the time of Elixir code that you're running for DK, and it's like it's obvious how much of an easier time you're having.
Yeah.
Rocking the concepts and just writing and just making stuff in it, right?
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but I think the biggest thing is that my brain thinks closer to how Elixir wants me to use it rather than how a true object-oriented language would be. I think we were talking, and you mentioned that Joe Sims, friend of the show, Joe, is super good at just kind of breaking things into class names and classes, the things that make sense. I'm not good at that. Part of it is I haven't had as much practice, you know, but another part of it is I think I feel like I think more procedurally, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. I mean, some people just grasp functional programming really well, and other people like, you know, more object oriented or imperative or whatever. I mean, there's a style for everybody, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of one of the great things about it all.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's going well. I'm working through the store admin side now. And so now I'm learning a lot more about, like Phoenix's forms and stuff like that. And it hasn't been hard at all. Like the only challenging thing is that some of the designs, for example, the store form, if you're a store owner and you want to edit your store's name or description or something, you can go to your store detail page and it has all of that information in forms. And so in the design, some of the information, it's just all like straight one form, but behind the scenes, there's actually different models in one form. So there's the store, there's store images, there's store logos, and there's also an addresses, and a store can have many addresses. It can have more than one. So contained in one form is basically all this relational data. And so that was kind of interesting to figure out, okay, how do we, you know, short of writing it in JavaScript and just, you know, putting different forms that talk to different API endpoints, I tried to figure out how do I actually just group this data in a way that I use it and have it work that way, you know? And so what I'm doing actually is I'm constructing a form, and it sends all the data to the endpoint that you would expect in just like an update form. And I deal with the data before it goes into change sets, before it tries to get put into the database and validated and stuff. So what I can do, since I know what store you're acting on, what user you're on, I can authorize everything, you know, authorize that you have access to the addresses and access to the store. And then what I can do is I can split up things into different change sets. So I can take the address information and deal with that. I can take the store images and deal with that. And then I can take the store data and deal with that.
So you're firing off a single request that contains like references to multiple changes that need to be made, right? Am I understanding that correctly?
Exactly. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I'm just grouping the data in one request instead of making a few different endpoints and then doing it in JavaScript on the front end. Like the current app does, I Yeah, the current app does that. It just kind of splits it up into a few different JavaScript forms and then you post to different endpoints. So then one has to, like, it has to check the addresses first and then validate it. And then it has to check images and validate that. And then it has to check. So basically on the current side, there's just sequential XHR requests. So if one passes, then we move on to the next one. This is a lot simpler for me because I'm moving that logic from the front end into a controller, or I can split it up into a module if I need to. So it's kind of all, I'm moving it from templates and JavaScript files into one spot in Elixir.
Sounds pretty fancy.
It works. I mean, so I'm learning more about Ecto. Ecto has a thing called Multi where you can, it's actually made for dealing with stuff like this, related data, and you need to act on it all at once, but I'm not even having to do that. So in my address schema, there's an update address change set, and then in my store schema, there's an update store change set. So basically, I just make individual change sets, which basically what that does is it groups the data and then it validates that data. So you can have multiple change sets for a schema. So a store can have, or a user can have, like a registration change set and an update change set. And you can validate information differently on those two change sets. So I just have the data going to the change sets that I need. I wrap the whole thing in a transaction. So if something bombs, that we don't have different states being saved. You know, it's surprisingly simple. At first, I wasn't really sure how to approach it, but I'm pretty happy that I didn't try to just do it how I know it could be done. You know, I wanted to learn how to do it, quote unquote, the right way, I guess. And I'm pretty happy that I stuck it out and did it that way.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing that kind of tends to get overlooked is people will learn a single way to do something and then keep doing that thing that way forever because that's how they learned how to do it, right? But as a developer, like that consistently pushing yourself to, even if you know how to do something that's like, I could do this this way and it'll be easy and it'll take me 3 hours, it can be so important to reevaluate sometimes and be like, okay, well, is that actually a sensible way to do it? And maybe if I do it this different way, it might take me 6 hours because I'm doing it a new way, but actually it's going to save me time down the road, or it's going to be way more efficient, or it's going to have some benefit, right? And that reevaluation and that relearning how to do things that you already know is such a critical and useful thing for devs.
Yeah, I mean, I got into back-end development through front-end development, and so most of my problem solving comes through that frame of mind, and so it would have been easy for me to just wire up some XHR requests and do them sequentially. And instead, I'm really trying to push myself in the back-end department, so I'm pretty happy with how that came out. And what's interesting is that in this rebuild, I have Vue 2 going and I have a Vuex store set up. So I'm handling things like notifications and other kind of global events and putting those in a Vuex store. But honestly, the vast majority of any logic is on the back end. So the front end is almost just representing state, not doing any sort of calculations whatsoever. It's just showing whatever the back end, whatever I put in the store. And it's working out pretty great so far.
Interesting. That sounds like a good candidate to go over on the live stream.
Yeah. I'm pretty happy with how even it works, you know, because again, most of the new site is server rendered, and basically I'm pretty happy with how I came up with getting JSON into the store in the first place. And it just happens in, I have an app component that wraps the entire site and it's an inline template. So the site displays and it shows before the JavaScript is even parsed. So there's not a flash. And then I have one prop, and that prop is just some JSON that I get from a Vue helper. That's it.
Nice and simple. If it does what you need and it works quickly, sounds good.
It's perfect.
Thanks again to Linode for their support of Does Not Compute. Anyone who deploys and manages virtual servers owes it to themselves to take a look at Linode. They offer incredible pricing starting at just $5 a month for a 1 gigabyte server, and awesome add-on services like backups and automatic load balancing. Head over to linode.com/doesnotcompute to learn more and sign up with the promo code DoesNotCompute2017 to get $20 in account credit.